The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Biden set to sign the first half of his signature infrastructure bill into law. Still in limbo, though, is his $1.9 trillion Build Back Better agenda.
American people have made clear one overwhelming thing, I think, and I really mean it. All the talk about the elections and what do they mean, and they want us to deliver. They want us to deliver.
But when it comes to the bigger social spending package, Democrats are going to have to go this alone, and they have almost no votes to spare. Five House moderates are still holding out for a CBO score before they will support the package.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. We'll get you up to speed on all the latest news and issues of the day every afternoon here, and I hope you will join me. If you're new to the broadcast, if you like what you hear, you can listen to us on the station you're now listening. Just remember to set it on your radio, or if you're listening on the smartphone, or if you say, hey, I want to hear that again, how can I do that? You can simply go to our podcast. You'll find them, Spotify, Apple, but you can go to relevantradio.com and just go to my show page. You'll find them there. And it's a great way to hear something you missed, a great way to revisit, great way to, you can download it, you can stream it, you can share the link. There's lots of ways you can get plugged in. If you are just joining me, I was sharing, and Maggie just posted this on our Twitter page. I would suggest you read this. I would suggest you share it with others. I was very impressed by a talk that His Excellency Archbishop Gomez had recently given. And he talks about the rise of secularization and how it really equals de-Christianization, and how this has really become, there are new political religions on the rise. You know, we have these social justice, wokeness, identity politics, successor ideologies that are being promoted right now. They're being championed, and people see this, they're embracing this as a new religion. If you're a person of faith, if you practice your Christianity, in some respects, in places you work, you sometimes feel like you're a minority. So what should be done? I mean, how should the church respond to these secular movements that are underway for change, for social change? Maybe you're confused. Maybe you're on that fence. Maybe you're like, I agree with some things. I disagree with others. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to respond. Archbishop Gomez, he said it very simply. I think sometimes simple's best. He says, look, you need to proclaim Jesus Christ. You got to live him, right? You have to proclaim him boldly and creatively. You need to tell the story of salvation in a new way. We talked about what he said about salvation, our story. But you've got to do it without fear. You got to do it with love. You have to do it with charity. You have to do it with confidence, because that's the church's mission since the time of Christ, in every age and in every cultural moment. Don't be intimidated, embrace it. I'm joined this afternoon by somebody who I thought would be so perfect to talk to you a little bit about. And if you want to get in on the conversation too, you can dial in at 888-914-9149. Those reflections by His Excellency on the cultural situation in our country today, and even some of those in Europe, are just too good. So go to Twitter at Drew Mariani Show. You'll follow him there. And I wanted to get Stephen White's take on this. He's executive director of the Catholic Project at the Catholic University of America, and a fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And he's joined me many times in the past. It's good to talk with him once again. Stephen, good afternoon. Welcome back.
It's good to be back. It's good to hear your voice, Drew.
Thank you so much. I was reading His Excellency's talk that he had given, and I just, there were so many good points. It was so rich. I thought it was just so insightful in terms of the cultural currents that are flowing through this country right now, and how deceptive, how indoctrinating they are for a lot of good people, and how in some respects it really is an attack on Christianity. I love your take. The Archbishop's insights that these social movements are a type of religion, I think that was a great point. I think it's important to understand. Do people who promote them understand them as a new type of religion? I'm assuming they don't look at it that way. I mean, religion is probably a bad word for them, but what do you make of what he said? And give me your take on this new religion, if you will.
Well, I think to understand Archbishop Gomez's critique of these new religions or pseudo-religions, as he calls them, you have to understand the first two points he makes in his speech, which are, one is sort of a restatement of secularization that we are sort of all familiar with, right? That religion seems to be receding in many places in the West. And when religion recedes, it's not that it doesn't leave sort of a vacuum in its wake, that it's generally replaced by some other ideology or some other attempt to sort of give a comprehensive explanation.
Stephen, I hate to do this to you. Stephen, do me a favor. I've got to take just a quick pause. Your audio is breaking up a little bit on me here. So I want everybody to hear you. Maggie, is that a little bit better? Stephen, try it again. Just pick it up. If not, I'm going to have to reconnect to you. Are you with me, Steve?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
We've got an audio issue here. So let me just hang on one quick second, okay? We're going to reconnect. Maggie, if you could get Stephen back on a better connection, I'd appreciate that. My guest today is Stephen White, Executive Director of the Catholic Project at the Catholic University of America. And we're talking right now about a piece I came across, and you're seeing how the sausage is made. Maggie's trying to reconnect, with him. We posted this article on Twitter, and you can find it at Drew Mariani Show. But let me go back. I'll share just another thought or two from His Excellency. And he talked about what we're seeing. We see tribalism in our country right now, right? And that's that we're at the risk of sliding back into that with this woke ideology, with all this talk of race. You know, the tribalism is kind of a pre-Christian idea of humanity. We're divided in these competing groups or factions. And what the bishop said was, look, we need to live and proclaim the gospel as the true path to liberation from every slavery, from every injustice, both spiritual and material. He says, you know, in our preaching and in our practice, especially in our love for our neighbor. And that's really what this is about. I think most people who get sucked up in this woke ideology and all this other stuff that we're now seeing, I think they care about their fellow man. I know so many millennials and so many young people who, you know, they want to be politically correct, and, you know, it's all about BLM and all this other type of stuff. But I don't think they see the big picture. Maybe it's the shortness, the span of their years. Many of them think right now might think, hey, you're wrong, and we totally get it. I think there's at the core of all this a desire for justice. There's a desire for love of one's neighbor. There's a respect for nature and for humanity. But I do think it gets twisted. I do. I think there's a real twisting of this today. And that's what happens. And is the Excellency says, so how do you make sure that doesn't happen? He says, we got to preach. You got the gospel. You got to practice it. You have to show love for your neighbor. You need to bear witness to God's beautiful vision of our common humanity, a common origin, a common destiny. And, he thinks as Catholics, as the church, the church right now has got to be a voice for individual conscience and tolerance. And we need to promote, you know, humility and we got to be the tip of the spear on all this. I'm joined right now by Stephen White. He's back again. Stephen, thank you for your patience. My apologies for that connection issue. It's good to have you back. So let me let you pick it up. I was asking you just about the bishop's insight on these social movements and how people have, you know, how he sees them as becoming a new religion. And I was just sharing a little bit of what he said on how we need to counter them. But give me your take on again, his address and the rise of these new religions. There's always been new religions. These seem to be pretty strong, and Christianity seems to be marginalized today.
Yeah. I think to understand his critique of these movements as pseudo-religions or new religions, I think we have to go back to sort of the first part of his address where he makes this diagnosis. He does that in sort of two parts. One is talking about secularization, which is something we're all familiar with. We see around us that as Christianity recedes or seems to wane in influence and culture in the United States and in much of Western Europe, what's left is not necessarily a vacuum, but a space that is filled by some ideology or some other way of sort of giving a comprehensive explanation or account of who we are. So it's filled with something else. And as that happens, you get these other pseudo-religions that come in to take the place of Christianity as it recedes. And the second part that's really important, I think, is that the racial and social tensions that we've seen here in the United States and other places, Archbishop Gomez takes those very seriously. He insists that the anger and frustration that followed, for example, the killing of George Floyd, are justified. And he insists that this country in particular has a lasting and real problem with racism and the way it infects our institutions and the way it affects us. Now, having said that, he then goes to say these movements that he's going to critique are a response to a legitimate crisis. They're not making this up, that there's a real problem, a real social and spiritual and civilizational problem, but their response to it is inadequate. And the reason it's inadequate is that unless we have a sense of our common humanity, the common fraternity that we share with one another as sons and daughters of God, our response to this real social problem is going to be a kind of tribal war against one group against another group. And that kind of response, where we then try and find some sort of quote-unquote salvation, not in God, not in grace, not in the next life, but in some kind of purely worldly resolution, where we pit one group against another, where we engage in a sort of a Marxist-inspired war of one group against another, that takes the form of a new religion. It becomes a new story that doesn't actually lead to reconciliation and peace. It leads to further conflict. And that's what he's warning about. The problem is real. The response is inadequate. And it's because that response is inadequate that the church can say, we have a better response.
Amen to that. My guest, Stephen White, if you want to join the conversation, you want to sound off, share your views, your experiences, feel free to ring in right now. The number's 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Stephen, Gosha has got a comment for you. She's listening in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Gosha.
I'm originally from Poland, and the reason the church has to be, it must be destroyed, is because it's too big of a power. If you have Poland, for example, from Poland didn't exist for 150 years because of the Prussia, Russia, and Austria-Hungary had invaded it. And then in 1920, and that's five generations, that's not one generation, that's five generations. In 1920, directly after the Second World War, First World War, they immediately came together, even though they hadn't existed for five generations, and made the country Poland again. And then it survived communism. The reason they have survived in history like this is because the Catholic Church has always been a power against any other force. They have to be destroyed. It's too much of a force. They can't win if they don't destroy that force.
Well, Gosha, thank you for calling. I'm going to let Stephen respond to you, but I think she brings up a great point. We look at look at history. Take a look at what happened in Poland. Take a look at what happened in any nation that was infected by communism, atheistic communism. They see the church as an obstacle, as a force that has got to be moved out of the way. Your thoughts on that? His Excellency touched on that briefly as well, but love to get your take, Stephen.
Yeah, I think the caller was right, but I think it's also worth pointing out that the church in Poland helped Poland, the Polish nation, even during the partition, survive in a way that it didn't necessarily help in other Catholic countries that also came under communism. And I think one of the reasons for that difference is it was Poland's experience of partition. When Poland ceased as a country, didn't exist on the map of Europe for more than 100 years, the faith wasn't just there. The faith was seen by the Polish people as an existential necessity. Without the faith, they were nothing. It wasn't just something they did on Sundays, maybe, right? It was seen as that the faith itself, the life of faith and dedication to the church was a matter of survival. Not necessarily in a physical sense, but it was what mattered, and it was the center of their life, and it was what gave life to them as a people. So the idea that you can just have sort of Christian inertia, a kind of Christianity that's just sort of you know, you go on Sunday, maybe you send your kids to Catholic school, and expect that to be something that perseveres through times of difficulty, through times of secularization, through even explicitly atheist attacks on the faith, that kind of faith won't persist. It's the faith that's seen as absolutely essential to who we are and absolutely essential and fundamental to what we do and how we live. That has a chance of persisting. And I think Poland demonstrates that in a historical way just from just the last couple of centuries.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right, our number here, if you want to get in, I only have Stephen for a few minutes today. I'll take a few more calls. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Patrick in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Patrick wants to join the conversation. Stephen, go right ahead, Patrick.
Hi there. I saw an article recently that there is a Lutheran bishop in Finland who's been arrested for basically a tweet, and it was a quote from the Bible, and I think apparently there's a law in Finland now that protects LGBT folks almost with a protected status, and the gist of the law is you're not supposed to, you know, encourage violence against them, but the authorities arrested the bishop because he posted a biblical verse that basically proclaimed men are men, women are women. Marriage is between a man and a woman, which is technically the opinion of the Lutheran Church in Finland, at least that variation, and he's in jail. And I'm not sure if Finland's in the EU, but if they are, it really concerns me. It's still happening in Western Europe, and the concern is it's going to go, you know, it's going to keep going westward, and it's eventually going to make its way here. So that's my concern.
Thank you, Patrick. I'll let Stephen respond. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, I don't know the Finnish case in particular, but I think this was actually something that Archbishop Gomez touched on in his speech was not just that there's deep disagreement, or not that the church has counterparts or interlocutors, people just having conversations with that don't believe. Yeah. It's that there's this totalitizing tendency that just not only removes God from the equation for some people, but says any other alternative is not welcome and has to be shut out. So you can't even have a dialogue. It's one side wins entirely or the other side wins entirely. And that's what he's arguing about. He's not saying there can't be dialogue. He's not saying that social justice isn't important. He's saying this insistence that there can be no mutual coexistence for people who proclaim what the church proclaims is something that is an existential threat. Right, we have to stand up to that. We have to call it out where we see it. That doesn't mean that anyone who stands up for social justice is bad or an atheist. It doesn't mean that anyone who stands up for racial justice is bad or an atheist. But when those movements, again, responding to legitimate crises, cut out entirely the God from the picture, that's a real problem. The church can't stand by and watch that happen. It reminds me of something that Pope Francis said in the very first homily he gave as Pope, which is there are a lot of things that we need to do. There's a lot of things that we need to – there's walking we need to do. There's building we need to do. I mean, we can walk as much as we want, and we can build many things, but if we don't proclaim Christ, we are not the church. We are just a charitable NGO, non-governmental organization. And what we end up proclaiming is when we don't proclaim Christ, what the church ends up proclaiming is what he called a demonic worldliness. And I think that's the point Gomez is making here. Yeah. We have to proclaim Christ. And if we don't, we're not proclaiming nothing. We're proclaiming something else.
A couple of things here, and I'm glad Patrick called. The remedy that Archbishop Gomez proposes is a pretty simple one, as you point out, the proclamation of the gospel. But there, you know, we got to do it in a way people understand. I mean, there are completely different understandings of people. For instance, Christians believe in sin. Secularists, they believe in victimhood. That's what we see. Everybody's a victim today, right? So how do you get people to hear the gospel? How do you get them to look at what's unfolding in the culture and the world through a different lens and not through that secularist victimhood, woke, you know, lens that they're currently looking this at? How do we best do that?
One way is to provide an alternative, live the gospel. I know that's easy to say and hard to do, but that is provide an attractive alternative in which you don't just say, but you show that reconciliation is possible, that you can meet someone who agrees with you entirely, someone who sees you as an enemy, that you're willing to treat them as they deserve, not as they would treat you. The second thing is to try and find common ground. If there was Archbishop Gomez's speech, how do we put this, kicked up something of a firestorm in Catholic media. There were a lot of people who were very upset with him, including Catholics who were very upset with him for what he said. He had sort of, you know, attacked some sacred cows of some people. The response, some of it was calling for constructive criticism. Like, look, there are people who are working with various social movements that are Catholic, and they're trying to find common ground with people who are trying to respond to real injustice. This, you know, if Archbishop Gomez painted with a broad brush that sort of eliminated some of that or didn't give credit where it's due, that's a problem. Fair enough. That's a fair criticism. But a lot of the response sort of made Archbishop Gomez's point for him. The response was just a lot of name-calling and anger and indignation, but not an attempt to engage with a different idea. It was as if these sort of new movements and the new names they go under, whether it's wokeness or whatever, are untouchable and they can't be criticized, and we will not allow any criticism of those. And that was sort of Gomez's point. We have to be able to talk about these because we're all sons and daughters of God. We have to be able to meet at least on that ground. If we don't have that ground because we've eliminated God from the equation, there's just you and me. There's them and us. And there's no common ground between us. And you can't have a conversation. You can't have a society. You can't have dialogue on that basis. And a lot of the reaction to what he said sort of proved the point that he was trying to make.
You're right. And Patrick, who talked about Finland and a lot of what we're seeing over in Europe, Gomez points out in the very beginning of his address that there is an elite. You know, there are globalists, there are others that are pushing this agenda. And it's one, he says, that is taking advantage of the pandemic. He says the pandemic kind of accelerated this. Something that would have taken decades to play out, it's happened in a very short period of time. And they're taking advantage of this so that they can move forward. What's that saying? You know, never waste a good crisis, right? In fact, he says when some people, you know, some people might think that the pandemic made these situations, he says, no, these were ideas. These were already in place. The pandemic was a springboard for them. That almost sounds conspiratorial. Your thoughts on that? What is he saying? How is he reading the powers to be, the movements that are behind this? Because, you know, we are seeing this, the new religion is secularization, and we see when secularization becomes worshipped, Christianity really becomes the enemy. But your thought on this elite group that might be pushing this agenda?
Yeah, you're right. It touches on it. He used some of the same terms that you will find in some more conspiratorial thinking. But I think here's why I don't think he's wrong. Now he spoke in fairly broad terms. He didn't specify any particular movement. Okay, he didn't name any particular names, which is in one sense makes his argument harder to refute, but also sort of spares some people from being named directly. But here's the thing: there were two of the sort of very most vocal responses to what he said was these are populist movements, and he's trying to tie them to some you know, Marxist elite at universities, and he's out of his mind. That's a conspiracy. Another very vocal response was, if you go back and you read all the literature that these Marxist professors wrote, he's not portraying it correctly, or he doesn't understand it. So it's one or the other. Either this is a movement that is being led and not started entirely by, but is in one state being led and perhaps even co-opted by a cast of intellectuals who are working off a particular Marxist ideology. Okay, then there are elites involved. But if he's not doing that, then why are the people who understand these Marxist ideologies the best insisting that he you know, didn't understand them correctly or he got certain points wrong? Like, it's one or the other. Either there is a Marxist ideology involved here or there isn't.
Yeah, they can't have it both ways.
So I think he really hit a nerve there.
There's so much more we could talk about here. I mean, there's so many different things from Gnosticism to communism to, you know, liberation. There's so much we could touch on, but we'll have to do it again because I'm up against the clock here. In the end, he says we need to live the gospel, right? That's kind of the bottom line. Why don't you give me a couple sentence wrap up on what the solution to the problem ultimately is through the eyes of His Excellency?
Yeah, he has a powerful line, a couple lines where he says, and I'm quoting here. He says the world needs you and me to be better witnesses,
Amen.
Better Christians. Let us begin by forgiving, by loving, by sacrificing for others, by putting away spiritual poisons like resentment and envy. I've got a piece coming out tomorrow for America Magazine where I highlight that as this is the takeaway. And a lot of the reaction and controversy shows that the Archbishop had a point that really needed to be made. And as Christians, it's incumbent upon us not only to avoid resentment and envy and to be a good example of this, but being a good example means that sometimes we don't wait for the other side to do it first. Right. Well, if this is an argument where there's a lot of acrimony, sometimes we need to be the first one to say, I'm going to take an act of goodwill so that we can have forgiveness and reconciliation.
Well, Stephen, I'm going to check out your piece. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about it. This is such an important issue for all of us to understand and be able to take that 30,000 foot view and see the currents and what is under what's happening, what's driving these movements in our culture and where it ultimately leads. And really, Christianity is the answer, solution. Jesus Christ is the answer. Stephen, keep up your good work. We'll talk again soon. I'm really grateful for having you here. Thanks for being
Thank
here.
Thank you, Drew. Always a pleasure.
All right. Stephen White, I've got to take a short pause. When we come back, I want to share with you, too, some fascinating archaeological finds over in Israel. I love this stuff. John the Baptist, one of them has to deal with him. Stay with me. I'll fill you in when I return.
Your daily dose of faith, hope, and charity. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. It's great to be here with you today. We will, of course, we posted that article, if you want to read it, on Twitter, at Drew Mariani Show. And I hope you'll check it out. I think what the bishop has had to say is just brilliant. My thanks to Your Excellency for just taking the time to address those issues. I get frustrated, I don't know about you, as we look at these, at the redefinition words, you know, the language that's currently being used, so many people being swept up into really what I think is the religion of the day. And I think His Excellency calls both you and me back to make sure that we're aware of how we ultimately change the culture and what our duty is today, you know, as Catholic. So, Maggie, I believe you'll have to give him a quick call. That's the way it works. So just get him up online. If you could do that, I'd appreciate that. Just use his telephone number if you could. Coming up in just a few moments, Father Dave Heaney, pastor of St. Bruno Parish in Whittier, California, is going to be with us. You might remember him. He used to lead the Rosary across America. And now Father Rocky is doing that. And, of course, you can join Father Rocky every evening at 7 p.m. Central Time to pray that Rosary across America. And we'd love to have you go ahead and do that. You know, I want to talk about some archaeological finds that have recently taken place. And I don't know if you know this, but Israel is now starting to allow tourist back into the country. And I've been all over the planet. I've traveled to South Africa, to Asia. I've been throughout Europe. I've been all over. I've been in the heart of Africa. One of the holiest places I think I've ever been to is Israel. And how can you not feel God's grace when you're there? I've prayed at Calvary, the very place where Christ poured out his blood, died, and threw open the gates of heaven where he conquered Satan and the evil one, right? Made us sons and daughters of God, you know. There's not a place on earth like that, you know. And just to look at the rich history of what has unfolded in Israel. You know, Israel is a small Jewish state, really. It's one of the most heavily vaccinated countries in the world. And yet they're still seeing a surge in cases. The Ministry of Tourism announced that foreign travel groups are going to be allowed in. They're not going to be requiring booster shots, though I think you do need to be vaccinated. And it's good news for Israel. It's good news for their tourism, which has suffered greatly since the pandemic. In fact, some of the tourists might be able to see some of the latest archaeological finds that have been announced. I came across a couple stories recently, and I thought I'd share them with you. There is a Byzantine church that is now in ruins, and they uncovered a mosaic on the floor with an inscription that reads, "Christ born of Mary." Right? Don't you love that? Some ancient cloth has been uncovered at what was a copper smelting site, and this cloth is dyed in royal purple. It's dated back to the period of King David, all the way back to the Davidic period. Think about how long that was, 1,000 years B.C.? And here's a truly breathtaking one. And I've always loved the story of Herodias, Herod's daughter, right, who danced. And that dance was so enticing to Herod that he promised up to half of his kingdom to her. And, of course, you know, she demanded the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And you know, he lost it as a result of that. I think, man, what kind of dance was that that Herod was willing to give up half his kingdom? That would be something else. Must be a lot of wine flowing. Anyway, I thought I'd invite back none other than Father Dave Haney. He is the, he was the great voice of the Rosary Across America for a long time. You'll remember his dulcet tones when he comes on. Pastor of St. Bruno's Parish in Whittier, California. And an amateur archaeologist. One night, Joseph Cora and Father and I, we were at an event at Relevant Radio, and the two of them were smoking cigars, and he was telling me all about his time on these archaeological digs. He leads archaeological pilgrimages to the Holy Land every year. And I thought there's nobody better than to have Father Dave with me. Father, welcome to have you back. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. Good to be with you.
Well, good to talk with you again. It's good to hear your voice. I came across a couple of these finds, and I just thought, you know, so often we think of the Bible as being myth. You know, people do. Oh, that story wasn't real. Was there really, you know, King David at the Battle of Baal took place? Whatever. Let's talk about a few of these. What's so significant, about some of these findings? For example, this ancient Byzantine church, where they find an inscription that is basically an article of our faith, that Christ was born of Mary. Fill us in. Give us some context, if you could.
Well, this is a Byzantine church. So this is a church that probably in the 5th century, maybe the 6th century, was found in the Galilee area. So this is the earliest Christian inscription from that area. Now, it was very common in Byzantine churches to have a stone. Sometimes it was a mosaic. Often it was a mosaic. Sometimes it was a stone. In this case, it's a stone. And it was carved in the stone, Christ born of Mary. And then it mentions two names. And this is very common in the Byzantine era, where the first name is the person they want to honor. And it's often the emperor. Sometimes it's the local bishop. In this case, it's the local bishop, Theodosius. And then also they want to honor the donor, the person whose, you know, gift, you know, made the church possible. And then they ask for everyone to pray for them. Pray for this bishop, pray for this donor, because the efforts of both of them made this church possible. And this church is the most important thing that we have in our community. So we want to honor them. And that was always placed in a prominent place, not always the same place. Sometimes it was over the door, sometimes over the altar, sometimes on the altar, always in a place where everyone would recognize who we're honoring and who we're thanking to bring us the most valuable thing we have in our community, which is this place where we share the Eucharist. And that was a very early understanding in the Catholic Church.
Wow.
And beautifully just developed in the Byzantine Church with these mosaics and these inscriptions.
That's awesome. You know, one of the stories that always intrigued me is the story of John the Baptist. And I love biblical archaeology. I mean, it seems every year there are reports of new finds that, you know, underline or really bring to life the reality of some of these Old Testament stories that can be thousands and thousands of years old. But, you know, one of the New Testament stories, of course, John the Baptist, right? Or the Salome who danced for Herod Antipas. And was so moved, probably opened his mouth and shouldn't have. Was willing to give away half his kingdom. Instead, you know, we know what happens. John the Baptist was condemned to death, and she wanted She wanted his head. They just found the dance floor where John the Baptist was condemned. They claim to have identified it. What do we know about this story, and how do they know this was it?
Great question. I think this is a pretty good story. Fortunately, it was dug up by an extremely reputable, very, very well-respected archaeologist. So that's the good news there. But, you know, the whole story of John the Baptist and Herod is fascinating because it's the juxtaposition of two amazing opposites. John the Baptist was a man of powerful integrity, very honest, total loyalty to God, a man of tremendous faith, hope, and love. And his life is inextricably bound up with one of the worst dysfunctional families in all of history. The family of Herod Antipas, who's the person in this story, you know, is one of the sons of Herod the Great. This is the most dysfunctional, evil, vile family you could possibly imagine. The family tree is so amazingly convoluted and confused because of incest and intermarriage, and it's just a complete, unbelievable mess. And John the Baptist pointed that out. And he publicly challenged Herod Antipas for divorcing his wife and marrying his niece. How about that? Herodias.
Wow.
So just
wow.
A terrible family. And, of course, it's fascinating that the Gospels indicate that Herod was fascinated by John the Baptist. He was fascinated by this person who was so opposite of him. So the Herod family had about 21 palatial, massive palaces slash fortress. These are beautiful palaces, a lot of rich ornamentation to them. They were also, at the same time, a fortress because the Herod family was paranoid that the people of the country would rise up against them because they were so evil and so vile and so greedy and high taxes and all that. So there's about 21 fortresses around the Holy Land. The easy ones to visit are the ones in Masada, the Herodium in near Bethlehem, in Jericho, and then up in the north in Caesarea. This one is called Machaerus. It's actually in Jordan, a little bit off the beaten path, not visited too often, but fully excavated. And they found this courtyard back in 1980. And they said, okay, that's the courtyard to the palace. But then just recently they uncovered an area with a kind of a semicircular set of stones, maybe 10 foot in diameter. And it kind of looks like the place where you would put a throne, like the apse of a church, like in the back of a church. It would be the bishop's chair, maybe. Mm-hmm. So this is possibly, you know, where Herod would have sat, you know, during this his birthday celebration in which Salome, Herodias' daughter, you know, apparently does this wild dance that so moves him that he offers half his kingdom. And you know the story.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the dance floor was already discovered, but it was just simply considered a courtyard. Yeah. But this new discovery seems to indicate that this was the place where Herod sat. And so this, you know, could be the place where famous dance occurred.
Well, I love it. I love the history, the window into time that mm-hmm. you paint for us to give us an understanding of what happens. There was one other story I'll touch on quickly with you, and I don't know how much you can share about this. It comes from the Davidic period, and they were able to date, I guess it was a piece of cloth, you know, that had, I don't know, somehow survived. I don't know how it survives that many years. I think it goes back to, 1000 B.C. Mm-hmm. Apparently, King David wore a piece of cloth. I think this was purple. What do we know about it, and how did it survive? You know, millennia.
Well,
that to me is what's so amazing.
Yeah, this is actually my favorite story because, you know, an inscription on a stone is still a stone. A mm-hmm. dance floor and a throne room is still stone. This is somebody's clothing. So this is a little bit closer connection to a human person. And that always makes archaeology much more vivid and much more, you know, realistic. So this is an area at the very, very bottom section of the modern state of Israel right now. You know, Israel comes to a very narrow point at its very southern border. So right there, in the most arid desert you can possibly imagine, is a valley called Timna Valley. Now, in the world of archaeology, this is a gold mine, literally. This is a very famous place. Because it's a place of mines, of mining, mainly copper. And from at least 1,000 years B.C., so 3,000 years ago. The place has been, very extensively excavated. There's also a theory that this is actually where Moses had the Ten Commandments, that actually Mount Sinai was actually in the wow. Timna Valley. I think that's actually more realistic and more valid. But in any event, this is a place of copper mines dated to the time of Solomon. And so we always talk about Solomon's copper mines, the treasures of Solomon. And so this is the place. And what they found was a small piece of cloth that's in the color purple. Well, my gosh, this is just riveting in the archaeological world, because we've always known that purple was the color of royalty. In order to dye cloth purple, even a small amount of cloth takes thousands and thousands and thousands of these very rare seashells wow. that are found up in the Lebanon coastline called murex. Thousands and thousands of these seashells, and they would excrete small amounts of liquid from the glands of these little seashells. Wow. And through a process that took many, many days, they would make a little tiny drop of purple. Well, there you go. Let's get another thousand. So that's why the color purple is a very, beautiful color. It's very captivating. It's the color of the sky before dawn. It's very, meditative. It's very beautiful. So, and because it was such a laborious process to make and so expensive, it was reserved only for royalty. So here we have
Father, hold the thought one yeah. second, okay? You know how this works because you're a radio pro. I've got to take a short pause here. I'm up against the clock. I don't want to interrupt you. I hate to do it because I'm fascinated too. When we come back, I'll let you finish that story as well. Feel free to join us if you want to. Final segment of the Drew Mariani Show coming up. It's 888-914-9149. Our conversation and our exploration of some of these ancient biblical mysteries and finds will continue when I return. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester. Well, it's great to be here with you today. I was watching a piece on CBN, actually. Somebody had sent it over to me a little bit earlier in the year. They were reporting on some important discoveries in Israel. And Maggie, maybe we can share some of that coming up in a minute or two. But before we do that, I want to welcome you back. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking this afternoon about some recent archaeological discoveries. These all took place, I think, in just 2021, this past year, with none other than Father Dave Heaney, one of my former colleagues here, a man who calls himself an amateur archaeologist. He often leads archaeological pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and the Holy Land is a place just rife with, history. It's amazing. When you read the Old Testament, when you read the New Testament, when you look at those biblical characters, when you have an opportunity to travel to the Holy Land, to spend time in prayer there, to go to places like Masada or the Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth, or to go to places where, the wedding feast of Cana took place, or to pray at Calvary, or to go to some of these places where these ancient mysteries are now being unlocked. One of my favorite stories was that story we just talked about of Herod and the place where John the Baptist lost his head over a dance. But when we left off, we were talking to Father about one of his favorite stories, and that was an ancient cloth. Dyed purple, and this is what's so amazing. The Davidic period, I think they carbon dated this thing back to about 1000 BC, which is pretty amazing to think about a piece of cloth, somehow purple textile fibers surviving millennia is amazing. And Father, I know you're educating a lot of people right now on even how this comes about. What makes purple so special? Don't they have berries? You say this actually came from a gland of a very small crustacean, right? Was it from Lebanon? Where was it that came in? And pick it back up.
Off the Lebanon coast, what we call Phoenicia, the Phoenician area, is where these very rare seashells were found called murex. But, you know, we take colors for granted today. You can pretty much have a shirt in any color that you want. Only a few colors were available, and they were kind of made by, you know, either animal products or vegetable products, you know, charcoal for black. Right. So the color purple would be extremely exotic. Very, very interesting. Nothing like you, very rarely do you see in nature even. And because it was so hard to make and such a rare seashell, that it was reserved. You were not allowed to have it yourself. It was reserved for royalty. So here they find in this Timna Valley, this area, the very, very extreme southern tip of the state of Israel, you know, kind of in the Sinai Peninsula area, they find this small piece of cloth and two things. You know, first of all, this is a 3,000-year-old piece of cloth, so some person wore this. This is shaking hands with history. This is, you know, touching something that someone wore. So really beautiful. The other thing is that the color is completely unfaded. It is the exact same shade that it had 3,000 years ago. That's the quality of this purple dye. Now, one of the reasons why it would stay the same shade is because where it was found. It was found in the Timna Valley. This is an incredibly arid, very, very dry desert condition. It's water that causes things to mold and decay and degrade. So things found in the desert, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, perfectly preserved, sometimes human remains, you know, anything that you find deep, you know, the Egyptian pyramids, anything that's really in a very dry climate will be preserved. So to find this piece of cloth, you know, means that we are connecting with the person who's running these mines. Maybe it was King Solomon. Who knows? It really is intriguing.
Ancient copper smelting, and this was what? Was it 3,000 years ago? When was this? I know when I was reading about it, Father, they said that the dye is mentioned in passages in the Bible about it's associated with the tabernacle in Exodus 26 or with royalty. And these types of finds shed new light on fashions that the elite wore or the royalty in those times as far back as 3,000 years ago. I love the story. It's an intriguing one because, you know, this is really a window way back in time. But your thoughts, and then also just I want to indulge myself with you personally. I know you call yourself an amateur archaeologist. You've been on digs. What have you discovered, or what have you been researching on those digs? What are scientists still unlocking? What are archaeologists still, you know, wiping the dust off of you?
I've been on 16. I've been to the Holy Land 16 times on these archaeological pilgrimages. I was on a number of what they call the Sifting Project, which was sifting dirt that was came from the Temple Mount area, and a lot of beautiful finds and discoveries there. Most archaeology right now is focused on what was daily life like at the time of Jesus, or in the Old Testament time. What did people have for meals? How did they make a living? What was their home life like? What was marriage like? What was child like? You know, what does it mean to what happened during in your home during the day? And that's really fleshed out our understanding of the Gospels. When we read the Gospels now, we understand so much more about what Jesus is saying and doing because we know the lifestyle of the people that he was talking to. I think the most amazing archaeological discovery to date is this. In the entire history of archaeology, everything that has ever been discovered so far has either been confirming of our faith or neutral, neither here nor there. There's never been anything ever in the history of archaeology that has ever gone against our faith. And that's really a very tremendous, beautiful testament to the authenticity and the historicity of our faith. And archaeology is this beautiful blend of science and religion. It's kind of a scientific analysis of religious history and religious artifacts. And so it's a good fit for me. I'm a son of a scientist, so it's something I just really, I'm fascinated by. And it's just been a beautiful affirmation of our faith. And let me just say one last thing.
Sure.
I can tell you when our people, our pilgrims are here, that Jesus actually, there's archaeological evidence that he did this here or walked on this street. It is infinitely much more moving, and people take off their shoes because they want their feet to touch the same places.
That's so awesome. You know, Father, first of all, let me say I miss you. It's good to have you back here. Thank
I remember
you
that for... great time we had with Joe Sikora. That was just a wonderful conversation.
I love the three of us sitting on that bench at night. Yep. You guys are, it was fun. Yeah. I hope our paths cross again soon. I really do. It'd be great to hang out with you and Joe again. But thanks. I'm out of time for today. I only have 30 seconds left here. So, Father, I'll remember you in my prayers. Please remember us in yours, okay?
Beautiful. Thank you, Drew. God bless.
All right. And say, I do. Please say a prayer for Father Haney there. I am out of time for the day. Thank you for allowing me to share just part of my day with you. I'll be back again tomorrow. 21 hours. You can set the clock. Until then, remember God loves you. And so do I. Have a good day.